Well, good morning, church. It is good to be gathered with you today and to have this opportunity to look into God's Word. As Steve mentioned, as we looked at the text ahead and we saw what was scheduled for this Mother's Day, we did have a couple of chuckles as we thought about some of the humorous ways that we might consider these passages in application today. Let me start, I guess, by saying Happy Mother's Day to all of you moms. I can confidently say that I would not be here if it weren't for my mother. And so, Mom, thanks. Luke chapter 8, two miracles of Jesus recorded for us. This miracle of Jesus calming a storm and another miracle of Jesus casting out demons from a man who was possessed. Of course, the main purpose for Luke including these stories isn't just to entertain us. Jesus is not just a celebrity who is, kind of making a name for himself and kind of putting on shows, and Luke is just kind of trying to write some clickbait stories to get readership. That's not what's happening. We understand that Luke has told us what he is doing in writing this. He wants us to have certainty about what we believe about Jesus. Who is he? I was thinking of it this way. We might liken what Luke is doing in his gospel kind of like a color-by-number sheet. Do you remember those? Those aren't too old-fashioned, are they? Kids still do them today? Okay, I see some old people nodding their heads like we know, right? But when you get a color-by-number sheet, it's just a sheet of paper with lines all over it, and there's these little sections, and those little sections have a minuscule number in them, and those numbers coordinate with a particular color. And so you go through and start to fill in each of those sections with the assigned color. And over time, as you keep filling in more and more sections and follow the order of the colors that are supposed to be there, a picture starts to take shape on the sheet. Eventually, until you've filled all the sections in, and now you know what the picture is. You can see it in all the details and shades and shadows. I think that's a bit of what Luke is doing. He's given us a color by number, and little by little, he's helping us fill in the sections to give color and detail and shading to this description and this image and this revelation of who Jesus, God with us, who he really is. And these two stories are aimed at adding some color to the sheet together here as we go through this series of Luke's gospel. So what do these miracles reveal to us about Jesus? What color, so to speak, do they add to the sheet as we seek to get to know Christ? Well, these miracles show that Jesus is Lord over the storm and Lord over evil. And these are important features. If Jesus really is God, if he is divine, then he must show his authority over all these realms. And these are some of the scariest realms. The chaos and the fierceness of storms that we have really no power against, and the chaos and fierceness of evil powers. He shows his authority and his rule over them. So we're going to look at these two miracles this morning in order. I'll spend most of my time on the first one, even though I know it's the shorter, and then we'll finish up with some comments on the last miracle. Jesus as Lord of the storm is recorded in just four verses here in Luke chapter 8, verses 22 through 25. You notice in the text there that Jesus tells the disciples that they need to go across to the other side of the lake. And Luke tells us that after the disciples set out, okay, they get in the boat, and they start navigating their way across the lake, that Jesus falls asleep. And as I was studying, I just kind of smiled and thought, moms, are you jealous? that Jesus can get in the boat and just fall asleep. And the disciples are navigating across the lake. What is the lake that they're going across? It's the Sea of Galilee. And the Sea of Galilee here has on the eastern side some particularly steep hills that are kind of forming a rim around it. And so it wasn't unusual for winds to sweep down from those elevated hills and sweep down onto the lake and cause sudden and fierce storms. And that's what happens here in this story. The storm comes blowing in suddenly. It appears it's very fierce. And the storm sweeps down and the lake gets very rough. Seas get very rough. And things get real bad real quick for the disciples. Luke tells us that the boat was filling with water. They're in danger. I've not had a circumstance where I thought I was going to sink a boat, but I do remember an occasion when Dad and I launched the boat to go fishing, and he forgot to put the plug in the back, and the boat just wasn't handling the same way. It was sluggish. It was slow. We were thought, boy, this thing is sitting low in the water, and we realized what had happened. But this is worse. The disciples are in a storm. Water's coming over into this boat, and it's starting to fill, and they're starting to feel like they're in danger. And remember, these were not guys who would be easily alarmed. They were fishermen, some of them by trade. They had experienced storms before. Some of them had fished on this sea before. They were accustomed and familiar with how to navigate a craft on the sea. My wife, Shannon, and my daughter, Esther, told me a story when they were visiting my in-laws in New Hampshire about an experience they had going whale watching. They did not see whales. There was rough seas, and they had a motor a couple hours out to get to the spot where they could see whales. But the rough seas made the trip arduous, and people started feeling ill on the ship. And eventually, the crew, I was told, made a PA announcement, "Do not vomit in the trash cans." And the ride was so rough that people were doing that anyways. They said, "Vomit outside the ship, off to the side." So Shannon and Esther said it was a horrible experience. There were people vomiting everywhere, and they were just trying to hang on and not join the chorus of puke. And they didn't see whales. They ended up coming back, and they have never gone on that whale-watching excursion again. But as awful as that trip was for them, Shannon and Esther never said they were in fear for their lives. It wasn't like the ship was taking on water, and they wondered what they were going to do. It was uncomfortable. It was unpleasant. But they weren't in danger for their lives. And so when you fear for your life, that is a paralyzing fear. Some of you have felt that. Or you didn't know if you were going to live. You were concerned. The danger and the fear that pierces you and terrifies you can paralyze you. This is what it seems the disciples were feeling. And there's some interesting, if not even exasperating, details in this account, because let's explore some of these a little bit. You see there in the text that you have these fishermen. They're trying to navigate this boat, and they can't do it. The ship is taking on water. They're in fear for their lives. And who do they ask for help? Do you see it there? Who do they ask for help? It's okay, you can answer this time, right? Who do they ask? Now, who is Jesus? Jesus is a teacher. He's a carpenter. He's a rabbi. And I just kind of had to kind of think to myself, this is not the guy that I would ask for help ordinarily if I'm in a ship and it's starting to flounder in seas. I mean, I'd be looking to the experienced fishermen to be the ones who would help. And so what I think what's happening here is Luke, again, is adding numbers for us to fill in on this sheet. There is something unique about Jesus. Maybe you think Jesus is just a good teacher who said wise things and winsome things or thoughtful things. Maybe he was kind and generous, somebody who lived a selfless life of an example that you should follow. But these claims that he's really God, maybe you're a little bit skeptical of that. How can he be that? Christianity is so exclusive to claim that the only way to know God is through Christ. That seems too exclusive. But friends, we have seasoned fishermen here that turn to Jesus for help when they fear for their lives. They turn to the rabbi in the ship when they're afraid. So there is something else going on here in who Jesus is. There is something that they know. There's a power present in him that they've experienced and seen in these other miracles that they've witnessed. Another matter of interest in this story is the storm itself. I mean, what are we going to do with this storm? In the ancient world, storms were usually attributed to much more than just atmospheric phenomenon that a meteorologist might talk about on the evening news. We have this in the scientific modern age, you know, we see weather patterns and it's kind of all scientifically described and they can predict weather to some degree a few days ahead of time. All of us Coloradans are thinking, well, really, can they? But we kind of have it all boiled down to the scientific analysis. But in the scripture, storms don't ever seem to be simply attributed merely to impersonal scientific phenomenon of weather patterns. For example, the scriptures attribute some storms to God personally, like the storm that Jonah was in when he was going the opposite direction that God told him to. And Jonah is asleep in the boat, and it says in Jonah 1:4 that the Lord that Jehovah hurled a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea so that the ship was threatened to break up. The scriptures there give God direct responsibility and causation for that storm. Job experienced a divine storm when God showed up finally and answers Job, and it says that God answered Job in a whirlwind. God showed up in a hurricane. And in Psalm 29, you have a psalm that's dedicated to praising the voice of the Lord. And it describes the voice of the Lord as something that is powerful. Quote, something that breaks the cedars, a voice that thunders and shakes the wilderness. And yet at other times in the scriptures, storms are attributed to the powers of demonic evil. Again, going back to Job, you have Satan, who is attributed as the one who is behind the storm that destroyed his livestock and that destroyed the house that his children were in, killing them all. So what was going on in this storm that the disciples were facing? Was it a storm that God was behind, a storm that Satan was behind? What are we to do with this storm? What's troubling also is that if Jesus is God, if he knows all things, then why would he tell his disciples, get in the boat, let's go across to the other side of the sea, knowing that there'd be a storm that would strike and put them in peril for their lives? Another feature of the story that can be troubling is the fact that Jesus was sleeping. Does that trouble you at all? I mean, they have to wake Jesus up. Does that bother you? I mean, think of this. Elijah. Do you remember Elijah the prophet in 1 Kings 18? He has this big contest between the prophets of Baal and him, the lone prophet of Jehovah God. And they put this altar together and he says, okay, here's the contest. Go ahead and call out to your God and have him consume the sacrifice. And they start running around this altar and start worshiping and crying out to Baal, and Baal doesn't show up. And Elijah starts to mock those prophets and says, maybe your God, maybe Baal is asleep. Maybe you need to wake him up. Maybe you need to shout a little louder. And then here in this text, you have Jesus asleep in the boat, and they have to wake him up. You ever wrestled with some of these details here in the story? What are we to do with this miracle? Well, look at verse 24. Keep reading. They went and woke him, saying, Master, Master. And I think though that description is very specific. Again, Luke is giving us more sections to fill in on our sheet. Master, Master, we are perishing. And he awoke and rebuked the wind and the raging waves, and they ceased, and there was calm. So whatever we learn from this miracle, we cannot miss the fact that Jesus is the Master. It is his voice that calms the storm. It is his presence, his power, with his mere words, stops the storm. And that is astonishing. We kind of read this here in Luke and think, okay, yep, neat. You know, Jesus did one of those Jesus things again. And we kind of just read it and carry on. But have you just stopped and considered how enormous this is? How many of you have lived through a tornado or a hurricane? Hands? Okay, see, so, and there's a number of you that haven't, but there's enough in here who have that I don't think any of you who have lived through that ever thought while the locomotive sound of that hurricane, we lived through Hurricane Irma, that you ever thought, you know, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to tell this storm to be quiet. I'm going to go out there and say, calm down! It's ridiculous. It's absurd. This is exactly what Jesus does. Jesus calms the storm and the wind stops. So what this shows us is that Jesus is greater than the storms of life. And I think that it can be an analogy that can be drawn from this physical, literal storm that they were in the middle of. You say, well, you're not in a boat and it's not taking out water. You're not fearing for your life. Okay. What is analogous to you in your circumstance of life that is causing you to be full of fear and wonder if you're going to make it through? And Jesus shows that he is greater than the storms of life that make us fearful. He is greater than the storms of life that we have no control over, that we don't even know where to begin to calm these storms. We wouldn't know how to start to calm the storm. Jesus is greater. He has a power that can overrule the fiercest powers we see in our world. And now back to some of those questions I was asking about. Jesus is asleep. Does that bother you? He tells them to get into the boat and the storm is coming. Does that bother you? As we try to resolve some of those tensions, I want us to understand also this. I mean, I could sit here and try to speculate on all these reasons why, but honestly, I don't know. God is God. But understand this. It was the storm that prompted the disciples to cry out to Jesus as Master. Sometimes the very thing that we hate most in our lives is the very thing that God uses to prompt us to call out to Jesus as Master. And that's exactly what they needed to do. They needed to cry out to Jesus, and they did it imperfectly. I mean, they were kind of exasperated. And Mark records that they asked Jesus this, "Don't you care?" Well, of course Jesus does care, but they were doubting that. He has the power to rule over that. In studying this out, I came across some comments that I found helpful, and they went something along like this. The sleeping Jesus shows us that sometimes God seems to take his time to respond to the storms in our life. Sometimes he lets storms come into our lives. He lets them rage on. He lets the boat start to sink. And it seems like all is lost. Like, when is God going to show up and rescue? He seems to let the storm rage on longer than we think it should rage. And the Bible is telling us in this picture of the sleeping Jesus that though God has complete power over storms, he sometimes does not act the way that we think he should. He doesn't act in the timeline that we hold for him. And that may not seem like great news, but it's very important that we realize this. Because what this miracle teaches us is a reality check on our expectations of Master. Is he really Master? Think about the illustration. It can be illustrated this way from another text of Jesus in John chapter 16. We have this tension of, okay, if Jesus can calm the storm, then why isn't he? If Jesus can make it go away, then why won't he? Well, in John 16:33, Jesus says this, "I have said these things to you that in me you may have peace." Peace. But now hear what Jesus says next. "In the world you will have tribulation. But take heart, I have overcome the world." Do you hear the conflict in that verse? He says, "I've come so that you can have peace, but let me warn you, you're going to have tribulation." And then he says, "But it's okay, I've overcome the world." But here's the challenge that we're faced with. We want it to be, okay, which one is it, God? Which one is it, Jesus? Will we have peace or will we have tribulation? Those two themes don't seem to go together again. It's like we look at Jesus and say, which one is it? Have you overcome the world or will we face tribulation? We see life that way. Like if Jesus has really overcome the world, then we shouldn't face tribulation, right? Or if we face tribulation, then that must mean that maybe Jesus hasn't overcome the world. These are the tensions that we feel, that we face. We want Jesus to calm every storm in our life immediately. We want him to keep us from ever getting in the boat to begin with. And when he doesn't, we wonder if he cares. We wonder why we must wake him up. We feel a contradiction between the Jesus who calms the storm and the Jesus who sleeps in the storm. But this passage tells us there is no contradiction between those Jesus. How do we resolve that tension? Well, look at how Jesus responds to the disciples. What does he tell them? What does he ask them? He said to them, "Where is your faith?" He wants them to look for their faith. You say, well, what does that mean? He wants them to put into action what they believe about him. In this circumstance, in this storm, if they would, they wouldn't need to be controlled by the paralyzing fear, and instead they would understand that Jesus is with them. And this miracle teaches us that when the presence of Jesus is with you, God is with you. And if God is with you, you can have peace, even in the middle of the storm. And I'll prove it to you by quoting from Psalm 46. Okay, look at the psalm. God is our refuge and strength. That is a statement of truth. Fact. A very present help in trouble. Another statement of truth. Fact. Therefore, here's the result. This is what happens when we get out our faith and activate it in the storms of life that we face. Therefore, what? We will not fear. And we think, oh, because everything is calm. Wrong. Keep reading. Though the earth gives way, earthquakes. Though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, right? Landslides that change terrains. Though its waters roar and foam. Hurricanes. Though the mountains tremble at its swelling. And then the Hebrew text adds this word, Selah, at the end there, which is, we think, a prompt to just stop and now consider that. Notice that the presence of God as our refuge and strength does not mean the storms don't happen. It means we need not fear when they do happen. Now, when I read this text originally, I was a little, again, exasperated because haven't you had times where you're in the ship, you're in the boat, you're in your storm, and it's raging, and you're trying to do everything you can, and you finally, out of desperation, yell out, Master, Master, we're going to perish, save us. And Jesus says, where's your faith? And there's times where you just don't want Jesus to tell you that. You just want Jesus to give you a hug. But that's missing what Jesus has done. Jesus does not condescend to us and just give us a hug and say, there, there, you'll be okay. Jesus entered our reality, our world. He gave up all rights of divinity. He suffered and was mocked and was belittled and denied and betrayed by those that were closest to him. He endured the physical horrors of Roman crucifixion, and it was him on the cross who was forsaken by God in the ship, in the storm. He was not rescued so that we could be rescued. He's done much more than give us a hug. Today we can look back at the crosswork of Jesus, and when we see that he is resurrected, that he reigns, and he rose up from the grave, our faith is what we need. That he is our refuge and strength. So Jesus' question to the disciples about faith means that when you go through storms in life, you must remember and take into your heart of hearts. You must believe at the core of your being that since he died on the cross for you, and because he rose from the dead, in him your eternal future is certain. Now, Jesus is Lord of the storm. He's conquered death. He's Lord of the storm. So any storm in this life needs to be perceived from that perspective. But why does God allow storms into our life, and why does he seem to act so slowly, or why does it sometimes seem he's not acting at all? And again, like I said, I can't give you detailed answers for why that is in your life. But I came across this illustration, and it was from Elizabeth Elliot, the wife of Jim Elliot, who was murdered taking the gospel to the Aucca Indians. She said, you know, you observe a farmer who is going to take care of their livestock, and let's say it's sheep, and these sheep need to be dunked in order to be treated so they don't get disease and have problems. And so the farmer takes these sheep and forcibly dunks them in this vat of treatment so that they're able to survive the hardships of the outdoors. And all through that, the sheep thinks they're going to die. And when they're fighting and thrashing around, and the farmer is just calm and just continues to treat all the sheep. And what do you want the farmer to do? Do you want the herdsman to just try to talk to the sheep and say, no, look at me in the eye, you're going to be okay, it's going to be all fine, it's going to be real scary. No, you've got a different order of being going on here, right? And the sheep's never going to really understand it. But they have a good shepherd. And that is true for us too. We have a good shepherd who is Lord of the storm. Now, when I say that, I'm not cheapening what you're going through. Moms, I'm not cheapening the storm you're going through as you raise young children. What I am doing is saying, keep crying out to your master. Keep crying out to your master. He is Lord of the storm. God will not be hurried. And by the way, that's a good thing, right? Do we really want a God who is hurried? who, when we wake him up, so to speak, when he finally, he's like, oh man, I'm sorry, I just kind of got a little distracted. I was checking out Instagram for a while and I missed out what's going on in your life. That is not the God we want. He's not hurried. And by the way, when we think that God is late, when God hasn't done what we want, that means what we're saying in effect is that we are wiser than God and we are better than God and we are more all-knowing than God. And do we really don't want a God like that, do we? So if we will submit to this, if we really will let Jesus be master, then what the disciples faced in themselves in this episode is that the fear they had for the storm, notice there at the end of this episode, they responded to Jesus calming the storm with this. They were startled. Their fear did not go away. It just exchanged objects. They went from fearing the storm to now fearing Jesus. There was this awe and amazement of Jesus who is Lord over the storm. And that's what we need to happen to us. That is where we can have peace and refuge in God, when we realize He is greater than the storm. There is a power greater than that storm. And then Luke moves on to another miracle. And don't worry, I'll be brief on this account. Verses 26 through 39, in the second miracle, Jesus delivers a man who is possessed by an enormous presence of demons. And again, I had a chuckle when I was thinking about Mother's Day. And I was thinking, maybe moms, you think that you are raising someone who is indwelled by many demons. Maybe you've had nightmares where you've talked to your child and they've looked at you and said, I am legion. That is not what this passage is talking about, okay? Sorry, moms. But don't you feel a little bad for the disciples? I mean, they get through this storm. Jesus calms the storm. And they step on land and then look what happens. They're in a non-Jewish area. They just survived the storm. They're puzzling through this awe and fear of, okay, Jesus just calmed a hurricane. The word that a hurricane on sea, I can't remember what that's called. Neither can you, obviously. But they step on shore and all of a sudden this crazy dude who's naked runs out of nearby tombs straight for them. I mean, can you imagine if you're the disciples, like, sheesh, give them a break. And by the way, doesn't that seem like what happens in life sometimes? So it seems like what's going on, what's going to happen here is not what's going to happen, right? I mean, he starts running right at Jesus and they're thinking, oh man, here comes this big fight. But that's not what happens. Jesus asks the demon for its name. They start having this conversation. And by the way, that asking for the name, I think, is probably Luke giving the reader a little bit of rope, in the sense of there was this assumption that in order for you to have power over a demon, you need to know its name so you can then commanded by its name to be cast out. And it was often done in kind of a formulaic way. You would know the name of the demon, you would cast the demon out in the name of someone who had greater power than the demon. This kind of formulaic approach to that. But the demon's clever. Do you see that? The demon really doesn't give its name, technically. The demon gives itself a description. The demon calls itself, do you see that in verse 30? Legion. Why? Because many demons had entered this man. Now, a Roman legion numbered anywhere from 3,000 all the way up to 8,000, depending upon when you would count. So wherever you want to pick, the issue here is that this man was possessed by an enormous presence of evil power. Calling itself legion shows the enormity of the evil present in this man. And Jesus is one guy. So what Luke is setting up here for us as readers is this. Jesus is enormously outnumbered, but he's not outmatched. He's setting us up as readers to be thinking, okay, this contest here, Jesus is definitely the underdog. He is way outnumbered, but he's not outmatched. Because notice, in this whole account, Jesus is calm in all of this. I mean, this crazy guy comes running out of the tomb. He's naked. Luke gives us some backstory on how much effort the townspeople had done in trying to calm this person, control this person. They could not do it. They would bind him and he would break the fetters, the power of this demonic possession. And so all along, all through this, it almost appears conversational with this demon. Jesus is very clear that he is the one with all the power. I mean, look at, Legion bows down before Jesus, right? He's begging Jesus. It's very clear, as Luke presents the facts, Jesus is the one with all the power. And interestingly, there's almost as much time given to the response of this miracle as there is to the actual miracle itself. Notice that the townspeople are told what happens, right? He has this interaction with these demons, with Legion. They're begging him, and they don't want to be destroyed. And so Jesus then gives permission again. The power is all Jesus here, and they enter into the herd of pigs. And by the way, this shows what demonic power does, what evil power does. It destroys life. And then the townspeople are told what happened, and they come out to see and investigate. And Luke tells us what they find, beginning in verse 35. Do you see that? And the reversals here are striking. I mean, the man who had been demon-possessed is now no demons. They're all cast out, all of them. The man who had been naked, now he's clothed. The man who had been crying and shouting, uncontrollable, is now sitting quietly. Again, some of you mothers wish you could have that effect on your children. He had been vexed, mentally unstable, right now, he's in his right mind. The man had no home. It was the tombs. It's not really a home. And now he has a place that Jesus says, I want you to go back here. And I think what Luke is showing us is this. Jesus has power over evil. Luke is showing us the gospel. He's showing us what Paul writes this way in Colossians chapter 1, verse 13. Jesus has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son. That's what has happened for this demon-possessed man. There has been a radical transformation, a deliverance from one domain of darkness, demonic oppression, possession, into this kingdom of his beloved Son. That's the good news of Christianity. In C.S. Lewis' book called Surprised by Joy, C.S. Lewis comments about what he was finding in himself as he started to examine his own life in light of the realities of the scriptures, of who God says he is. And C.S. Lewis says this, quote, of himself, when he looked inside of his own heart, he says, there I found what appalled me, a zoo of lusts, a bedlam of ambitions, a nursery of fears, a harem of fondled hatreds. My name was Legion. This account reminds us this, that we are all legion on our own. Without God's decisive saving intervention in our lives, we are as hopeless as this man in the tombs, troubled, destroyed. That is us apart from God. And what Luke is showing us is that Jesus is the one who travels across the sea through the storm, comes into an area that is not home for him. It was a Gentile area. There were pigs, herds there, and there's all this cultural stuff going on here that would have been awkward. It would have been difficult to be there and kind of one of those places, oh, let's just avoid that. We don't need to go there. And Jesus goes directly there and interacts with this demon-possessed person and casts out demon and saves him. That's the gospel. That's who Jesus is. And so a question I think that Luke would want us to ask ourselves is this. Whatever else you know about Jesus, do you know the saving power of Jesus like that? Do you know Jesus like that? Now here's the challenge. In our modern American context, we want Jesus to be our servant. We want to continue to be master. We want Jesus to give us the life we want, give us the things we want, give us the experiences we want, give us the joy we want, give us the pleasures we want, give us the life that we're pursuing. And as long as Jesus can be a helpful companion on that process, then we're good with it. But then sometimes Jesus puts us in the storm and it makes us wonder, and we're reluctant to call him master then. Do you know the saving power of Jesus like this man who surrendered, had helpless, could not save himself, entirely at the mercy of Jesus, and found the saving power of Jesus? Well, as you look at the end here, we'll wrap up. Not everyone was thrilled with this encounter with Jesus. Look at what the townspeople, how they respond in verse 37. The townspeople asked Jesus to leave. That's a little bit of a puzzler, right? They were more comfortable with the demonic than they were with being near the power that cast out the demon. Or maybe they were upset at the financial loss that happened as a result of this miracle, right? I mean, this herd of pigs was killed. Maybe they were okay with the demonic so long as their bottom dollar, their bottom line wasn't affected. Either way, the townspeople were trying to get away from Jesus, but not the one who had been rescued. And by the way, that's one of the evidences of true saving grace, of truly bowing to Jesus as Master, as Lord. When there's this desire to know Him and to be with Him, and that's what this man wants to happen. You see in verse 39, all of this is leading up to this statement that Luke gives to us here, this instruction that Jesus gives this man. This man is begging him, is begging Jesus, please let me go with you. And you see what Jesus says in verse 39? Return to your home. Again, this is what God does for us in Christ. He gives us a home, a place to truly belong. Go, return to your home. Now notice what Jesus says, and declare how much God has done for you. But look what Luke says next in verse 39. And he went away, proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for him. And I think that's the punch of this miracle. He's setting us up as readers, Luke, for this phrase, right? Jesus says, go and tell everyone what God has done for you. And what does the man do? He goes and tells everyone who? Jesus has done for him. And so we're forced to ask the question as readers, well, then who is Jesus? And that's exactly what Luke wants you to wrestle with. He is God. What you just saw display, the power of Jesus over the demons, casting them out, giving this man a home, the transformation that occurred, the deliverance from that power, that's something only God could do. And so Jesus says, go tell him what God has done for you. And this man can't but help say, I'll do exactly that. Let me tell you what Jesus has done. Jesus is God with us. He is Lord over the storm, and he is Lord over all evil. I'll ask our music team to come and get ready to lead us in our final hymn. What are we going to do with all of this? There are so many applications to be drawn, to be pressed into our hearts and our lives. Whatever we do as we walk away from this text, we need to remember and understand. We as Christians live by faith. It's this firm grip upon the person and work of Christ. And so, moms, as you continue to raise children, whether they're littles or whether they're adults, and you feel the burdens and the yearnings in your hearts for children that are following you or perhaps not following you in matters of faith, remember this, that Jesus is Lord over it all. He is the one that can save a man from legion. He is the one that can calm the storms. And even if God in his wisdom continues to let the storm rage on in your life, I want to encourage you to keep turning to him. He is master. And he is pleased when you come to him. Jesus did not rebuke the disciples that they asked him. He responded to their request. And friends, you can be sure he will respond to yours too. Let's pray.